Well, then what we have been doing this weekend, okay. So one of the things that we've done was to strip away a lot of the myths around when we talk about ancestry, when we talk about the ancient spiritual traditions of the lands. We had to look at some of the myths that have collected around that. And in a way, what we did was to really look at the way in which both in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and more recently in the 20th and 21st century, there's a layer of fantasy has been sort of built up around our ancient traditions. And where that left us really was the rather stark but very clear understanding, I hope, that our oldest magical book in Britain is the History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth, also his Vita Merlini. All the other work, and I'm not saying there aren't older traditions and all the other, but there are older traditions here as well, but the poems of Taliesin, the triads of Britain, the Mabinogi, the Black Book of Carmarthen are at least 100 years later than the traditions we find written down in Geoffrey of Monmouth. Geoffrey of Monmouth is the first place, therefore, that we hear about Arthur. He is also, and the thing about his History of the Kings of Britain is that is in itself is a magical book. So what he does in that book is begins by drawing a relationship between, he gives us first of all a description of Britain as a magical island, as an Eden. And it's the sort of thing that you would use as a contemplation practice for tuning into the spirit of these islands. And then what he does is he gives us a history where the British are what he calls the remnants of Troy. They are the people. They are descended from the Trojans. Now, that's an important magical hint. Because what he is saying, and there's a whole detailed history about how he describes it, but what he's saying is that there is a link between these ancient magical traditions and the magical traditions that we find in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey are all concerned with, the Iliad is in particular, it's concerned with many things, but magically it's concerned with, the Iliad is concerned with the power of illusion. And the Odyssey is concerned with how to free ourselves from illusion. And both books are concerned also with a particular method of working with the inner energies that we find first of all in the pre-Socratic philosopher Parmenides, who talks about descending into the underworld to meet a mysterious goddess and learning from her the mysteries of truth and illusion. And this figure is connected really with the idea of both the wolf and the bear. And the teachers of this particular tradition are called Phalarkos, the lords of the lair. And one of their fundamental practices is the practice of incubation, where you invert your senses, go in and down into the underworld, and to work with the spirits that you find there.
Could you spell Phalarkos?
Phalarchos. Phalarkos, Lord of the Lair. They are connected also with a particular form of Apollo called the Apollo who kills and makes alive again. And to sometimes it's called the wolfish Apollo, or Apollo Kunomaglos. Now, in a certain sense, through those hints, which if followed up by somebody who knew what they were doing, that he helped somebody then to see, okay, what we're looking at here is how have these ancient traditions translated into this land, into this place. And what we get is a description of the kings. Now, why a description of the kings rather than anybody else? Well, that's because right at the heart of the traditions of the Philarchos is the idea of the goddess and the Kouros. The Kouros is the Kouros, the word means young man. The goddess names Parmenides Kouros when Parmenides in vision comes before her. The Kouros are these kind of stiff figures, archaic figures. They have long sort of braided wigs, and they stand rather like that, and they're normally naked, and they are the sort of, if you like, the masculine principle that is the servant of the feminine principle. So here we're looking at the creatrix as the goddess, and we're looking at the sort of the masculine principle being, if you like, the sword or the shaft of light that arises out of the womb of the mother. And the task of the Kouros is to descend into the depth, is to die in the bosom of the mother and to be reborn as her messenger. Yeah, it's a turning about. Yes, exactly. It's a repetitive kind of process. Now, the kings are Kouroi. The kings are the magical kings, the sacred kings that are being described in these traditions are examples of Kouroi. Now, in Greek tradition, one of the things you later find out is that Jesus is sometimes referred to as the Kouroi of Mary. And the shape that you get with Jesus and Mary is very like the Parmenides sense of the goddess and the Kouros. Kouroi, K-O-U-R-O-I is Kouroi, is plural. Kouros is K-O-U-R-U-S. Okay. Kouros, but it was in Greek. Now, the person who is the Kouros is the servant of the mother. Can be male or female, actually, but it's conventionally it's sort of the female is conventionally, and you know, in these days, it's, you know, the whole thing is much more fluid. In their days, the priestess would have been the, if you like, the exemplar of the mother, the priest, the exemplar of the Kouros. But this is the same process that we find in Welsh tradition as Mabon and Modron, the mother and the son. So when we start to look at the kings, we're looking at these figures who embrace sovereignty, who take the position of being the messenger of the creatrix, of the divine creative force, and who are at the service, therefore, of the Grail Spirit, at the service of the Spirit that continually recreates something. Mm. Now, the chant that we used earlier today is in the Apocryphon of John is made by Jesus. So one of the things that's very important as we continue to explore these traditions is this fusion of Christian and pagan tradition. Not one replacing the other or pushing out the other, but it's a genuine fusion. So when we come back to the chant, where is it?
Let me say what the name of that book is.
Which book? This book. This is called The Sangreal Sacrament by William Gray.
The chant was called...
The what?
What was the chant called?
The chant is from the Apocryphon of John. Apocryphon of John.
We spelled that earlier, don't we?
We did spell it earlier, so you've got... So in the and so this chant would in the original Apocryphon is made by John. This is John with his Jesus, rather, beg your pardon, with his disciples making this chant. So the people who are doing Amen in the original book are the disciples around the apostles and disciples around Jesus. And this is Jesus, in a certain sense, taking his place as a sacred king, as the person who is mediating the energies and who is going to die and resurrect in the service of those energies. Now, where we come to we're going to explore much more of this book as we go along, but we've got very little into it at the moment, but actually one of the issues around this book is it's very dense. So let me just jump to the place that we did get to, which is about Bath.
Which book is
this? This is The History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth. So where do we get to? Do you digress after the death of Brutus? Here we go. So where we come to really is a sense of these magical kings who are holding that center point, bringing everything kind of together. And we're told Bladud, his son, this is the son of Hudibras, who's one of the earlier kings, reigns for 20 years. He builds Bath. He made hot baths in it for the benefit of the public, which he dedicated to the goddess Minerva, in whose temple he kept fires that never went out. And so we have this sense of Bladud as a servant of the goddess who creates the ever-burning fire, and then who is the teacher of necromancy, who is the teacher of working with the ancestral traditions. Now, what we went on to look at really then from there was to look at the way of working with these ancestral traditions. And in a later portion of Geoffrey's book, there is a thing called the Prophecies of Merlin, which gives us the description of a king who is not in sovereignty. Vortigern, the king, who is inviting in the energy of disorder in order to prop himself up, and whose tower cannot stand because of that. And what we're given then is a description of Merlin as who is the bridge maker, who is the magical child born of a spirit and a nun, and whom at first Vortigern wants to kill to offer him. It's instead of the, you know, if we think that the essence of sovereignty is sacrifice, where you offer yourself. It's your life you offer, nothing else. But what to the distortion that is Vortigern, he wants to offer an innocent child in place of himself. But what that book goes on to describe and to show us is the practice of truly working with ancestral energies, which is that descent into the earth, descent into ourselves. We're then shown this great pool of ancestral life, which as we sort of penetrate takes us to these energies that are in separation. And then the breaking of the restriction of the vessels that brings the energies of life together, which then comes together in Merlin, and then he's set free of time and space, and we're shown a whole kind of process of creation and destruction. In a sense, what is shown to us there is ancestral work. It involves the personal, but it's more than personal. It's about the whole universe. So it begins at the beginning of things and takes us right to the end of things. And in that process, all the fixity within us is stripped away and recreated. And there are a number of stages within that we're shown. So first of all, we're shown the chaos, the power of the energies bouncing all over the place. Then we're given the energy of a man seated on a white horse, holding a white rod, turning aside the course of a river, so that as if turning a millstream, so that a new energy starts to rise, and we engage with the energies of the ancestors, engage with the goddess of the land who holds the walls of London in one hand and the woods of Caledon in another, and as she walks through the land, awakens the ancient beings of the land, and then they are then worked with and propitiated and things are changed as a result of that. The noxious fountains are dried up and the new life is found. And then there's a third version where the root and branch changes place and the newness of things shall be a miracle. And then we're into the great field of the universe, the great field of the planets and the stars, which again we see falling apart, stripping away the destruction in a certain sense, both of the natal horoscope and the world order that we know, so that everything returns into the goddess and then is recreated from her. So that's him. We'll go over this in practical detail later, but we're shown in that book. This is just why I went and did the punch voice about her. This is how you do it, because this is how you say, this is this work. This is how you do this work. Right?
Which book was that? Last bit in, was that in?
This is all in the History of the Kings of Britain.
Okay.
This is the bit called the Prophecies of Merlin. Right. What are we doing? Okay, good. That's done. Okay, so in a certain sense, what we're going to do is work with this book, and then work with some of the other material, the Mabinogi in particular, to help us understand these magical traditions. We're not going to try to become experts on Geoffrey of Monmouth or the Mabinogi or Welsh or anything like that, because what we're doing is exploring a particular magical tradition that is about the manifestation of the Grail. Now, one of the I'll just hand this around for people to see. One of the people that we will be drawing on, as well as my usual teachers, is one William Gray, who Marcus's godfather, and who, when I realised I have this picture, but I have this picture, so if I just send it round so people can get a glimpse of Bill when he's in middle age, when he's cycling 40 miles up from Cheltenham to the Rollwrights. Because he's a Kabbalist who brought together the Kabbalah with these ancient traditions, and so he's going to be quite a help to us in some ways. Now, part of the particular way he's helped us this weekend is we've used part of his Rollwright ritual as a way of understanding some of the deep roots of this work. Because having on the last occasion gone right back to the beginning of Paviland and the Red Shaman, part of what we've been looking at this time is this vast tract of time when we're looking at the barrow builders, the round barrows, the long barrows, the circle builders, and trying to understand, part of what we looked at is how later things have been pushed onto that. But if we engage with that magically and intuitively and listen to that, we have to work with the complication of our own reactions to that. But what we find is a similar tradition to the ones that we're finding out of Homer and that we'll start to find written in these sources. So as we explore these sources, one of the things that will become clearer to you, I hope, is the fact that there is something does get transmitted over time, not in the way the 18th and 19th century writers talked about as an external organization, but a way of thinking and a way of being and a way of exploring keeps on returning, keeps on transmitting itself. And right at the heart of that is that the Parmenides' teaching, and the thing above all that he says that he learned that helped him to do this work, he learned something he called Hezekiah. Hezekiah is inner stillness, is that entry into stillness, and then the following of that stillness. One of the great qualities the great Welsh bards possessed was something called Tau. which is means just silence. But if you go back to some of the earlier traditions around the word, it's sometimes called the silence that sings. And if you go back to the old Welsh root of it, thank you, it is the tau is the sound that a frozen river at midnight makes as it starts to melt.
Put it there.
I have put it there. So this is the equivalent of Hezekiah. It is the sense of the descent into the unknown, into the mystery. Now, what we have done both with the house of life is our literal house of life, our literal interior. I feel like it is an image of our own interior. And as we work with it, as we explore these traditions, you will find some of these things reflected within the house of life. For example, as we've journeyed into the room of the establishment this time, there's a little cave entrance which can take us to the Red Shaman's cave. Similarly, you will see that as we have worked this weekend, the sense of the hallows of the Grail have become more prominent within the house of life. So the sense of the sword and the circled cross and the stone altar and the sense of the rod running through the castle have become more prominent. What we went on to do then as well, as we worked with some of these things, is to use Bill's roll right ritual, a version of the roll right ritual, to engage with the root energies of the hallows. So we engaged with the sense of the circle of stones, the rod, the sword, the cup and the womb cup, and the engraved stone, which holds the pattern of things. Now so what we did, if we go over that meditation we did just after we came back, we first of all listened to music. We first of all just listened to music, which might have felt quite random to you, but actually was chosen to look at both the ring cosmos, the ring chaos, and the ring past not. So that was, without saying a word, was setting up a field. Then what we did was go into a meditation where we worked first of all with the three great rings. And then establish ourselves at the center of the circle, at the center of the rings, bringing together those sense of the opposites. Chaos, order, bringing together life and love, light and law. Being the center point, being the grail bearer. We then find ourselves on the sweet track, moving through time and space. We then find ourselves at the roll right stones, then being challenged and moving through these different places, taking birth within the circle, within the pattern shown us on the shield. Then we arise out of that. We come together in groups of three. We contemplate the stone circle in front of us. We choose a random card, and then each of us places the card in the stone circle, and then what we explore for ourselves is the story that then arises about the onward carrying of the Grail in our time here and now. Now, one of the things that is central to all of this is the ability to be in that center point and to bring harmony together. This is also central to Tolkien's vision, which we haven't really had time to look at this weekend. We'll come back to another time, where he looks, where his whole vision of the universe is about harmony and disharmony, and about how harmony arises from disharmony. Now, one of the things that we have looked at time and time again over these last 2 days is to look at the sense of connection and weaving. And the sense of, as we stand in this central place, we are connected to everything.
I wanted to ask.
Yeah, go on.
Could you spell the Sandolphin?
Sandolphin, yeah. Yes.
And then there's the Metatron,
yeah.
And
then
there was a third one.
Suviviel.
How do I spell that?
Okay. Suviviel is S-U-V-V-I-E-L. Suviviel. Sandalphon is S-A-N-D-A-L-F-H-O-O-N. S-A-N-D-A-L-P-H-O-N. M-E-T-A-T-R-O-N.
I haven't really got a handle on your suburbia. The energy of fluid movement, is this correct?
Of connection. The energy, a suburbia is the energy that connects everything else.
Thank you.
So traditionally, I mean, if we were ritualizing these qualities, so Raphael holds the sword, Mikael the rod, Gabriel the cup, Uriel the stone, Suviviel the cord that connects.
That's a big thing with Bill Gray, isn't it, the cord?
Yeah. Yeah, he does a lot about that.
A question, if you finished.
Go on, go on.
So, we move through time and space from the sweet track to the worldwide stones, and then I think you said took birth in it.
If we look at what happens to us in the meditation on the worldwide stone, first of all, we're challenged, right? And we have to give something, and then what we give, something important, that is given back to us, but is changed when it's given back. We're then pointed to before we can enter the circle of stones, we're pointed to the king's stone, which is the stone of the rod, and there we commune with all those who have taken up that sense of sacred sovereignty. And if we choose, we step into the stone, we commit ourselves to being part of that. And as we step out of the stone, we then find ourselves just in front of the barrow of the Whispering Knights. And by following this whispering sound, we come to the mother in the barrow, whose face we cannot see, and who gives us to drink, but who somewhere in the giving of us to drink, we are drawn into the cup itself. Mm. And if you like, in a sense, are born through the cup, coming out the other end of the barrow, finding ourselves the other side of the circle of stones, confronted by the guardian. And now the guardian holds up a shield or an inscribed stone that shows us a pattern that if we step into this first circle of stones, we commit ourselves to working with that pattern. Would you be one with we? Because there's something that the guardian says. The pattern, that whole pattern of the circled cross, the pattern of the of life, it's about that. The pattern is, will you work with this? Will you join us in this work? And then the stepping into that circle, so just stepping into, taking birth within the field of those who work with the circle, the circled cross and the tree of life.
Okay, and I had a bit of a strange thing with that.
Yeah.
Felt like, I don't know how to explain it, but almost like a piece of paper, but not a piece of paper, something not physical,
yeah,
was going through my head.
Yeah.
And I was slightly alarmed at that and wondered, what's going on here? And I came back quite disorientated.
Okay. So it came straight through your head that way, or how did it do it?
I think it was that way.
Okay. So it's like a cutting motion, or something being lost, or what was the feeling?
It was disorientating.
Yeah.
And it felt like something, yeah, came through me.
Yep.
I was still there.
Yeah.
But there was these, like, it just disoriented me.
So something happened there, right, that takes you away from your normal sense of yourself, that disorientates, that takes you into a different place.
Mm-mm.
Okay? That often happens in these things. So that sense of disorientation is very kind of normal, definitely okay. And what happened next after that? What then happened?
Well, then I was sort of confused. And then did we end quite soon after that?
Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, what's going on? Am I here? Am I there?
Yeah.
Like, everyone was just opening their eyes, quite normal. And I was
Okay. So you're still in that disoriented place. So then we come into the exercise with the stones. The stone.
And I didn't help anyone. I was like, it's all a bit weird.
Okay. So when you looked at the stones, when they were all laid out, what did you see? What was the thing that happened to you when you looked at that story?
I had the trumpet.
Yeah.
And it was like the light was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the noise was being made, but the light was coming in, and the little bird was there. And there was some connection, and there were lots of birds. And I can't remember what I said, but something about the needing to be still and to listen, and to work with birds and to work with nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to the centre. I can't remember what the centre was. And there was a robin on a hand,
mm-hmm,
and a deer drinking from the pool.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that sounds like you then find your way into something that then talks to you about what could happen next.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's fine. So it's grounded.
Okay. So it's just accept that sense of disorientation is part of
it. No, it's absolutely necessary. Right. Disorientation is necessary in this work, right? Because we're breaking down our old perceptions, old senses of self, and allowing new possibilities in. So the disorientation is always part of that. And something like that paper coming through you is really cutting something adrift, okay? So it's, I don't know where I am, right? So then you're open then to what happens next.
Okay, and the answer is in what I saw and what I spoke.
That's right.
I feel like I've been with disorientation most of the weekend.
Okay.
And usually I can be all over the place on the Saturday, and then on Sunday it resolves.
Yeah.
But I'm still in that, and I do feel it's okay, because this is 3 years we're going to be working with this.
Yeah.
So I feel it's taken me into something which is, and I long for the space. I long for the nature. For the I long for that.
So sorry, when you say you long for the space, what do you mean?
But there's something about, you know, here is everything all thrown up all over the place, trying to get my head around it.
Yeah, okay. I see what you mean.
Space and...
Okay, the thing is, what we're doing is exploring a spiritual tradition, right? We're exploring a spiritual tradition that's very ancient, that has real depth inside it. But we're at the beginnings of exploring that tradition. And part of what we've had to do this weekend is to look at some of the distortions around that tradition. So I spent a lot of yesterday trashing ideas. You know, so I took apart the eight festivals. I took apart most of the things that people think we know about this ancient tradition, ancient British traditions. And that isn't, I don't think that's easy. I don't think that's easy for anybody to hear, because actually what we want to, the thing is, what we all want, I think, at least what I want is, well, what is this path? What is the simplicity of this path? Well, it's not a simple path. It's a poetic and elusive path that we have to puzzle out. Okay, and sort of, and using our experience of the natural world, using our experience, inner experience, using our experience of the existing text, we have to listen to something that is, in a sense, the voice of the Grail Spirit itself, working underneath and through all these processes to show us something. Phil,
I'm not sure if he's going to come up in the future. But if there feels something like a poetic truth that Blake is going to be important in all this.
Yeah.
I know Blake had his own mythos, you know, which is all, you know, possibly quite distracting maybe. But there's something, and of course Blake was one of these, you know, Parliament Hill kind of druidic.
He was.
There's something about Blake, I don't know, there's something about
what I like about Blake, right, is Blake is really understands the bringing together of opposites. I suspect we probably won't deal with his cosmology, because his cosmology, that would need a course of its own, because it's a whole complex cosmology. But where Blake, so if you look at the Songs of Innocence and Experience, the most extraordinary book really about looking at opposites. And what's the one about the devil?
Marriage of Heaven
and Hell is another. So there are some aspects of Blake that almost certainly will come in here, because it's about, because what we're looking at is the fusion of opposites, and the standing in that place where the bringing of opposites together heals the splits of the world. So that's the place that he was the prophet for, in some ways, really, you know. And of course oddly, particularly given the circumstances now, is that, well, you know, he writes also about America and about the idea of the new world of America and kind of, and the new possibilities around that. So yeah, he'll come in, no doubt. So there we go, still got going on, good. So when we think about, okay, what do we do going forward? So now we've got a gap now over December, and kind of, so it's about, you know, 8 weeks or something till we meet again. We've covered an awful lot of material in these first three meetings. So what I would really encourage you to do is to sort of listen to the lectures again, go over the material, recognize that what we're doing, I mean, not much of stuff is familiar to those of you who've worked with me for years, I know, but we're doing something new. Because what we're doing is looking at this ancient British tradition that brings together the Kabbalah, the Christian tradition, ancient Welsh tradition, and is it sort of its own thing, has resonances way back into Homer, into the Iliad and the Odyssey. But fundamentally is about the being at the service of life. Now, the House of Life meditation gives you a practice. So the Kabbalistic cross, the middle pillar exercises, are exercises designed to wake up your energies, to create a balanced field of energy inside you. House of Life is a exploratory process where you can more deeply waken up these energies using your imagination, and also explore the rooms of the house. It's an integrating form, so that you can, for example, from the Hall of Establishment, you can fall at the base of the house. You can go to the Red Cave of Pavilion, the Red Shaman's of Pavilion's cave. The energies of the Hallows are embedded within the castle, so that you can. And in a certain sense, the round table is simultaneously the circle of the Rollright stones. The King's Stone is the rod running through the castle. The Guardian and the Sword is found in the little chapel beyond the mirror. the stone altar is both in the chapel and the mirror and in the base of the castle. So the House of Life is an integrating form where we can revisit these meditations. We can do the meditations again, just as we've done, just by listening to them, and see what comes up for us. But the thing that's important about this is to remember we're at the beginning of a whole process. Now, those of us who did the last 3-year course, in some ways the structure of that was much clearer because we were exploring the paths of the Tree of Life. So you know what you've got. This is a bigger deal. This is a bigger process that we're involved in because we're exploring really this ancient tradition of the service of the Grail and the myths around Arthur and the way in which this has developed through ancestral life in this land. So it's a much less formed exploration. I mean, obviously easier for me because I have a real sense of these traditions, but I would encourage you, if you're feeling confused, to know that you're in the right place, because you're touching on something that mostly is unknown to you. And you can, if you want to read something about the tradition, well, then I would start with Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. But I would read it very lightly, and read it in relationship to some of the things we've said about it. But probably at this stage, you don't really even need to read anything anyway. Just listen to them. The thing to do is listen to the talks, go over the meditations, work with the she cards, find yourself in all this material. I've thrown a huge amount of exercises and material at you over the last couple of weekends. Done a lot this weekend, right? So there's a whole kind of now one of the things, if you do want to read something, I suppose that's true. I'm not going to recommend you go to the core text of the tradition. You could read some of Bill Gray's work, in particular. You could read his Well, anything by Bill is quite good, but the Sangreal Sacrament is probably the thing that's most close up to what we're doing. You could also read his book called The Roll Rite Ritual, which really relates to the meditations we've been doing. He's written a very good book about the Kabbalah called The Ladder of Lights, and another excellent book called Magical Ritual Tradition. So if you want to read beyond this, I'd probably recommend reading some of Bill's works and see.
What's the last one, the
Magical Ritual Tradition. Magical, beg your pardon, Magical Ritual Methods.
Okay. What was the first one again?
Sangreal Sacrament. Spelled Sangreal, Sangreal Sacrament.
Magical ritual
methods.
Methods.
I think.
What about your book here that's about to come out? What's that about? Is that related to this?
You're not going to like it. It's about Aleister Crowley. So,
that alone.
I think you should. It's up to you. I think because you've got such stuff about Aleister Crowley. So if I were you, it's a book written. I have a different opinion about Aleister Crowley than you do. Clearly, I wouldn't have written a book about him if I hadn't. Obviously. It doesn't deal with any of the outer materials that we're looking at. It's absolutely about the heart of what we're doing, because it's about the movement from the book I've written really is about the movement from what we might call the external shape of magic into the heart of magic, into the heart of working with the Tao, which is also the Tao. So that my book is absolutely about that. But if you hate Aleister Crowley or think he's evil and horrible, well, it won't be an easy read, will it? Because most of it's about Aleister Crowley. So use your own discrimination with that. So don't get into it.
What about reading Moonchild, though?
Oh, Moonchild's brilliant. I mean, I would very recommend it. But she's not going to read Moonchild. She hates Aleister Crowley. That's even worse, isn't it? It's like read the devil himself, not the interpreter of the devil. You know, so I don't think that's going to work as an idea, really. Yes, my book is about the way of deep magic is about to come out. It's magic, so I will have some copies available when I'm at Hawkwood. And there will be copies available when I next see you in March, no doubt. But
Say something about what the meditation you've just done, because I just remembered I did a fae in a big thing that as soon as you took us somewhere, I found myself on top of the tour. Uh-huh. And the whole country swung round under me. So I was orientated, as you put the harrows in, with the direction
to
the tour.
Mm.
It never happened to me before.
No, I know, that's unusual.
But Faye will be proud of you. Even during the meditation, I thought, oh, I didn't see you there, Faye, but I knew you were people. And I thought of your fortune's chance at the Alex, you see, and we've just done that invocation.
Yeah.
That effective invocation, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, that's a tiny.
No, that's fine. No, that's lovely. That's very nice. And very unusual for you to do that, yeah. God, you've got a lot in there. So the thing is, we've done a lot, okay? So there's a whole sort of. So part of what the gap involves is consolidation. Right, so. You're not going to have any fresh input from me now until the middle of January, and that's good because we've done a lot, right? So there's something about just go over it. Remember, we're at the beginning of something, and actually we're at the beginning of something that's quite big. This is the last 3 year course for those you did. It was very contained, right? We knew what we were doing. We were exploring the paths of the tree of life. That this is a much bigger exploration about exploring a whole spiritual tradition. That is a fusion of the Kabbalah, of Welsh tradition, and of Christian Gnostic tradition, and will almost certainly take longer than three years to explore. But if within 3 years, we can create a basic foundation for the practice of it somewhere.
This is part one, is it?
Well, we'd love to see where I am after 3 years. I'm maybe knackered.
Something you said about how. I just kind of want to use it to just crystallise it. We kind of get these, when you strip away the fantasy,
yeah.
How they speak back to us.
Yeah. No, I think that's us. And anyway, that's kind of what happened when you brought in the mound that you did that you'd excavated. Because that was one of those magical kind of moments where you brought in something. Because you did it just to the point where we've been stripping away all this stuff. And then you kind of bring in the mound. And then what we did was, without projecting onto the mound, work with the image of that particular mound that you brought in through your experience, which then brought us into both a sense of appreciation of that particular mound, but also that whole territory of working with mounds and working with... Because the tonality of working with the stone circles, working with the barrows, is it takes us right into the stars, right into the life and death energies of the universe. And so it takes us into that very fundamental place. In a way, and in a way it's interesting because the Pavlan Shaman does that, but the Pavlan Shaman is so far back. It gives us that sense of deep time, but it's a bit unrelatable to. When we start relating to the stone circles, even though they're thousands of years old, they're much more within the environment that is known to us. Mm-hmm. And we're back with the Pavlan Shaman, we're with the hyenas and mammoths, and Britain as a kind of a jungle rather than as a temperate forested place. So we make this big jump forward into something that's still a long way back, but is more relatable than that earliest kind of strata.
The thing about the Pavlan Shaman for me was that I hadn't met it before. Mm. And I have a whole thing about standing stones. You know, I have a whole history of my own life. But
yeah.
So that felt much cleaner.
Well, that's much easier. Well, of course, it's easier because you're going back so far. No, that's true, of course. And then there are things about it, but how does that go forward? Okay.
Is the whole land thing and interpretation and stripping away the fantasy, there's also the mythic strain and the myths accumulate around the land, and this is in the nature of myth, one of the definitions of myth, I think, that
we reinterpret it in order to fulfil the needs of the present.
Yeah, true. That's true. And in a certain sense, if we like, we think of the needs, the particular needs that we have sitting here, where we're trying to explore an ancient magical tradition. One of the needs, therefore, that exists within that is to get rid of the obscuring myths, so that we can find, well, what is the grail within it? What is that that regenerates? That yeah. which does not regenerate is not the grail.
Yeah. Because once they've been expressed, of course, they continue to obscure
yeah.
the light of the future. Yeah, got it. Yeah.
We can regenerate, so we can move away.
Yeah. We can. But now we're going to stop because we're at the end of our time. So let's just sit together. Let's just sit together for a moment while I thank the archangels, and then you can all go home. The archangels will go home and you can go home. Sandalphon Metatron, we thank you. Go in peace. Sabuviel, we thank you. Go in peace. Auriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Gavriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Mikael, we thank you. Go in peace. Raphael, we thank you. Go in peace. May we all go in peace.